Nightfall by Isaac Asimov and Robert Silverberg. A Foundation book published by Doubleday, a division of Bantam Doubleday Dell Publishing Group, Incorporated. Copyright 1990 by Nightfall, Incorporated and Agberg Limited. In fond and reverent memory of John W. Campbell, Jr., and of those two terrified kids from Brooklyn, who in fear and trembling made the awesome pilgrimage to his office, one of them in 1938, and the other in 1952. To the reader, Calgash is an alien world, and it is not our intention to have you think that it is identical to Earth, even though we depict its people as speaking a language that you can understand, and using terms that are familiar to you. Those words should be understood as mere equivalents of alien terms, that is, a conventional set of equivalents of the same sort that a writer of novels uses when he has foreign characters speaking with each other in their own language, but nevertheless transcribes their words in the language of the reader. So when the people of Calgash speak of miles, or hands, or cars, or computers, they mean their own units of distance, their own grasping organs, their own ground transportation devices, their own information processing machines, etc. The computers used on Calgash are not necessarily compatible with the ones used in New York or London or Stockholm, and the mile that we use in this book is not necessarily the American unit of 5,280 feet. But it seemed simpler and more desirable to use these familiar terms in describing events on this wholly alien world than it would have been to invent a long series of wholly Calgashian terms. In other words, we could have told you that one of our characters paused to strap on his quanglishes before setting out on a walk of seven vorks along the main glebish of his native Znoob, and everything might have seemed ever so much more thoroughly alien. But it would also have been ever so much more difficult to make sense out of what we were saying, and that did not seem useful. The essence of this story doesn't lie in the quantity of bizarre terms we might have invented. It lies rather in the reaction of a group of people, somewhat like ourselves, living on a world that is somewhat like ours in all but one highly significant detail, as they react to a challenging situation that is completely different from anything the people of Earth have ever had to deal with. Under the circumstances, it seemed to us better to tell you that someone put on his hiking boots before setting out on a 7-mile walk than to clutter the book with quanglishes, vorks, and glebishes. If you prefer, you can imagine that the text reads vorks wherever it says miles, glizbas wherever it says hours, and slush traps where it says eyes. Or you can make up your own terms. Vorks or miles, it will make no difference when the stars come out. I-A-R-S. If the stars should appear one night in 1,000 years, how would men believe and adore and preserve for many generations the remembrance of the city of God? Emerson. Other world? There is no other world. Here or nowhere is the whole fact. Emerson. 1. Twilight. It was a dazzling foresun afternoon. Great golden Onos was high in the west, and little red Dovim was rising fast on the horizon below it. When you looked the other way, you saw the brilliant white points of Tre and Patru, bright against the purplish eastern sky. The rolling plains of Calgash's northernmost continent were flooded with wondrous light. The office of Claritan 99, director of the Jonglor Municipal Psychiatric Institute, had huge windows on every side to display the full magnificence of it all. Shirin 501 of Saro University, who had arrived in Jonglor a few hours before at Claritan's urgent request, wondered why he wasn't in a better mood. Shirin was basically a cheerful person to begin with, and 4 Sundays usually gave his normally ebullient spirits an additional lift. But today, for some reason, he was edgy and apprehensive, although he was trying his best to keep that from becoming apparent. He had been summoned to Jonglor as an expert on mental health, after all. "Would you like to start by talking with some of the victims?" Claritan asked. The director of the psychiatric hospital was a gaunt, angular little man, sallow and hollow-chested. Shirin, who was ruddy and very far from gaunt, was innately suspicious of anyone of adult years who weighed less than half of what he did. "Perhaps it's the way Claritan looks that's upsetting me," Shirin thought. "He's like a walking skeleton." Or do you think it's a better idea for you to get some personal experience of the Tunnel of Mystery first, Dr. Sheeran?
Sheeran managed to laugh, hoping it didn't sound too forced.
Maybe I ought to begin by interviewing a victim or three, he said. That way I might be able to prepare myself a little better for the horrors of the tunnel.
Clariton's dark beady eyes flickered unhappily. It was Cubello 54, the sleek and polished lawyer for the Jongleur Centennial Exposition, who spoke out.
Oh, come now, Dr. Sheeran, the horrors of the tunnel. That's a little extreme, don't you think? After all, you've got nothing but newspaper accounts to go by at this point, and calling the patients victims, that's hardly what they are.
The term was Dr. Clariton's, said Sheeran stiffly.
I'm sure Dr. Clariton used that word only in the most general sense, but there's a presupposition in its use that I find unacceptable.
Sheeran said, giving the lawyer a look compounded equally of distaste and professional dispassion.
I understand that several people died as a result of their journey through the Tunnel of Mystery. Is that not so?
There were several deaths in the tunnel, yes, but there's no necessary reason at this point to think that those people died as a result of having gone through the tunnel, Doctor.
I can see why you wouldn't want to think so, Counselor, said Sheeran crisply.
Cubello looked in outrage toward the hospital director.
Dr. Clariton, if this is the way this inquiry is going to be conducted, I want to register a protest right now. Your Dr. Sheeran is here as an impartial expert, not as a witness for the prosecution.
Sheeran chuckled.
I was expressing my views of lawyers in general, Counselor, not offering any opinion about what may or may not have happened in the Tunnel of Mystery.
Dr. Clariton!
Cubello exclaimed again, growing red-faced.
Gentlemen, please, Clariton said,
his eyes moving back and forth quickly from Cubello to Sheeran, from Sheeran to Cubello.
Let's not be adversaries, shall we? We all have the same objective in this inquiry, as I see it, which is to discover the truth about what happened in the Tunnel of Mystery, so that a repetition of the unfortunate events can be avoided.
Agreed, said Sheeran amiably. It was a waste of time to be sniping at the lawyer this way. There were more important things to be doing. He offered Cubello a genial smile. I'm never really much interested in the placing of blame, only in working out ways of heading off situations where people come to feel that blame has to be placed.
Suppose you show me one of your patients now, Dr. Clariton, and then we can have lunch and discuss the events in the tunnel as we understand them at this point. And perhaps after we've eaten, I might be able to see another patient or two.
Lunch?
Clariton said vaguely, as though the concept was unfamiliar to him.
Lunch, yes, the midday meal. An old habit of mine, Doctor. But I can wait just a little while longer. We can certainly visit one of the patients first.
Clariton nodded. To the lawyer, he said,
Harim is the one to start with, I think. He's in pretty good shape today. Good enough to withstand interrogation by a stranger, anyway.
What about Justin 190?
Cubello asked.
She's another possibility, but she's not as strong as Harim. Let him get the basic story from Harim, and then he can talk to Justin. And, maybe Chimelet. After lunch, that is.
Thank you, said Sheeran.
If you'll come this way, Dr. Sheeran.
Clariton gestured toward a glassed-in passageway that led from the rear of his office to the hospital itself. It was an airy, open catwalk with a 360-degree view of the sky and the low gray-green hills that encircled the city of Jongleur. The light of the day's four suns came streaming in from all sides. Pausing for a moment, the hospital director looked to his right, then to his left, taking in the complete panorama. The little man's dour, pinched features seemed to glow with sudden youth and vitality as the warm rays of Onos and the tighter, sharply contrasting beams from Dovim, Patru, and Trey converged in a brilliant display.
What an absolutely splendid day, eh, gentlemen?
Clariton cried with an enthusiasm that Sheeran found startling coming from someone as restrained and austere as he seemed to be.
How glorious it is to see four of the suns in the sky at the same time. How good it makes me feel when their light strikes my face. Where would we be without our marvelous suns, I wonder?
Indeed, said Sheeran. He was feeling a little better himself, as a matter of fact. 2. Half a world away, one of Sheeran 501's Sorrow University colleagues was staring at the sky also. But the only emotion she felt was horror. She was Sephira 89 of the Department of Archaeology, who had been conducting excavations for the past year and a half at the ancient site of Beklamat on the remote Sanjakan Peninsula. Now she stood rigid with apprehension, watching a catastrophe come rushing toward her. The sky offered no comfort. In this part of the world, the only real light visible just then was that of Tano and Sitha, and their cold, harsh gleam had always seemed joyless, even depressing to her. Against the deep, somber blue of the two-sun-day sky, it was a baleful, oppressive illumination, casting jagged, ominous shadows. Dovim was in view also, barely just rising now, right on the horizon, a short distance above the tips of the distant Horkan Mountains. The dim glow of the little red sun, though, was hardly any more cheering. But Sephira knew that the warm yellow light of Onos would come drifting up out of the east before long to cheer things up. What was troubling her was something far more serious than the temporary absence of the main sun. A killer sandstorm was heading straight toward Beklamat. In another few minutes it would sweep over the site, and then anything might happen. Anything. The tents could be destroyed. The carefully sorted trays of artifacts might be overturned and their contents scattered. Their cameras, their drafting equipment, their laboriously compiled stratigraphic drawings, everything that they had worked on for so long might be lost in a moment. Worse, they could all be killed. Worse yet, the ancient ruins of Beklamat itself, the cradle of civilization, the oldest known city on Kalgash, were in jeopardy. The trial trenches that Sephira had sliced in the surrounding alluvial plain stood wide open. The onrushing wind, if it was strong enough, would lift even more sand than it was already carrying and hurl it with terrible force against the fragile remains of Beklamat, scouring, eroding, reburying, perhaps even ripping whole foundations loose and hurling them across the parched plain. Beklamat was a historical treasure that belonged to the entire world. That Sephira had exposed it to possible harm by excavating in it had been a calculated risk. You could never do any sort of archaeological work without destroying something. It was the nature of the job. But to have laid the whole heart of the plain bare like this, and then to have the lousy luck of being hit by the worst sandstorm in a century. No, it was too much. Her name would be blackened for eons to come if the Beklamat site was shattered by this storm as a result of what she had done here. Maybe there was a curse on this place, as certain superstitious people were known to say. Sephira 89 had never had much tolerance for crackpots of any sort, but this dig, which she had hoped would be the crowning achievement of her career, had been nothing but headaches ever since she started, and now it threatened to finish her professionally for the rest of her life, if it didn't kill her altogether. Eilis 18, one of her assistants, came running up. He was a slight, wiry man who looked insignificant beside the tall, athletic figure of Sephira. "We've got everything nailed down that we're able to," he called to her, half breathless. "It's all up to the gods now." She replied, scowling. "Gods? What gods? Do you see any gods around here, Eilis?" "I simply meant..." "I know what you meant. Forget it." From the other side came Thuvik 443, the foreman of the workers. He was wild-eyed with fear.
"Lady," he said, "lady, where can we hide? There's no place to hide."
"I told you, Thuvik, down below the cliff."
"We will be buried. We will be smothered."
"The cliff will shelter you, don't worry," Sephira told him, with the conviction she was far from feeling. "Get over there, and make sure everybody else stays there."
"And you, lady, why are you not there?"
She gave him a sudden, startled glance. Did he think she had some private hiding place where she'd be safer than the rest? "I'll be there, Thuvik. Go on, stop bothering me." Across the way, near the six-sided brick building that the early explorers had called the Temple of the Suns, Sephira caught sight of the stocky figure of Balik 338. Squinting, shading his eyes against the chilly light of Tano and Sitha, he stood looking toward the north, the direction from which the sandstorm was coming. The expression on his face was one of anguish. Balik was their chief stratigrapher, but he was also the expedition's meteorological expert, more or less. It was part of his job to keep the weather records for them and to watch out for the possibility of unusual events. There wasn't much in the way of weather on the Sanjakan Peninsula normally. The whole place was unthinkably arid, with measurable rainfall no more often than every 10 or 20 years. The only unusual climatic event that ever occurred there was a shift in the prevailing pattern of air currents that set cyclonic forces in motion and brought about a sandstorm, and even that didn't happen more than a few times a century. Was Bollock's despondent expression a hint of the guilt he must feel for having failed to foresee the coming of the storm? Or did he look so horrified because he was able now to calculate the full extent of the fury that was about to descend? Everything might have been different, Sephora told herself, if they'd had a little more time to prepare for the onslaught. In hindsight, she could see that all the telltale signs had been there for those with the wit to notice them. The burst of fierce dry heat, excruciating even by the standards of the Sajikan Peninsula, and the sudden dead calm that replaced the usual steady breeze from the north. And then the strange moist wind that began to blow from the south. The colubrids, those weird scrawny scavengers that haunted the area like ghouls, had all taken wing when that wind started blowing, vanishing into the dune-choked western desert as though demons were on their tails. That should have been the clue, Sephora thought, when the colubrids took off and went screaming into the dune country. But they had all been too busy working at the dig to pay attention to what was going on. Sheer denial, most likely. Pretend that you don't notice the signs of an approaching sandstorm, and maybe the sandstorm will go somewhere else. And then that little gray cloud appearing out of nowhere in the far north, that dull stain on the fierce shield of the desert sky, which ordinarily was as clear as glass. Cloud? Do you see a cloud? I don't see any clouds. Denial again. Now the cloud was an immense black monster filling half the sky. The wind still blew from the south, but it was no longer moist. A searing furnace blast was what it was now, and there was another wind, an even stronger one bearing down from the opposite direction. One wind fed the other. And when they met...
Sephora!
Bollock yelled.
Here it comes! Take cover!
I will! She didn't want to. What she wanted to do was run from one zone of the dig to another, looking after everything at once, holding the flaps of the tents down, wrapping her arms around the bundles of precious photographic plates, throwing herself against the face of the newly excavated octagon house to protect the stunning mosaics that they had discovered the month before. But Bollock was right. Sephora had done all she could this frantic morning to batten down the site. Now the thing to do was huddle in, down there below the cliff that loomed at the upper edge of the site, and hoped that it would be a bulwark for them against the fullest force of the storm. She ran for it. Her sturdy, powerful legs carried her easily over the parched, crackling sand. Sephora was not quite 40 years old, a tall, strong woman in the prime of her physical strength. And until this moment, she had never felt anything but optimism about any aspect of her existence. But suddenly everything was imperiled now. Her academic career, her robust good health, maybe even her life itself. The others were crowded together at the base of the cliff behind a hastily improvised screen of bare wooden poles with tarpaulins lashed to them. Move over, Sephora said, pushing her way in among them.
Lady!
Thuvik moaned.
Lady! Make the storm turn back!
As though she were some sort of goddess with magical powers. Sephora laughed harshly. The foreman made some kind of a gesture at her. A holy sign, she imagined. The other workers, all of them men of the little village just east of the ruins, made the same sign and began to mutter at her. Prayers? To her? It was a spooky moment. These men, like their fathers and grandfathers, had been digging at Beklamat all their lives in the employ of one archaeologist or another, patiently uncovering the ancient buildings and sifting through the sand for tiny artifacts. Presumably, they had been through bad sandstorms before. Were they always this terrified? Or was this some kind of superstorm?
Here it is, Bollock said. This is it.
And he covered his face with his hands. The full power of the sandstorm broke over them. Sephora remained standing at first, staring through an opening in the tarpaulins at the monumental Cyclopean city wall across the way, as though simply by keeping her gaze fixed on the site, she would be able to spare it from harm. But after a moment, that became impossible. Gusts of incredible heat came sweeping down, so ferocious that she thought her hair and even her eyebrows would burst into flame. She turned away, raising one arm to shield her face. Then came the sand, and all vision was blotted out. It was like a rainstorm, a downpour of all too solid rain. There was a tremendous thundering sound, not thunder at all, but only the drumming of a myriad tiny sand particles against the ground. Within that great sound were other ones, a slithery whispering sound, a jagged scraping sound, a delicate drumming sound, and a terrible howling. Sephora imagined tons of sand cascading down, burying the walls, burying the temples, burying the vast sprawling foundations of the residential zone, burying the camp, and burying all of them. She turned away, face to the wall of the cliff, and waited for the end to come. A little to her surprise and chagrin, she found herself sobbing hysterically, sudden deep wails rising from the core of her body. She didn't want to die. Of course not. Who did? But she had never realized until this moment that there might be something worse than dying. Beklamot, the most famous archaeological site in the world, the oldest known city of mankind, the foundation of civilization, was going to be destroyed purely as a result of her negligence. Generations of Kalgash's great archaeologists had worked here in the century and a half since Beklamot's discovery. First, Galdo 221, the greatest of them all. And then Marpin, Stinopad, Shelbik, Numoyne, the whole glorious roster. And now Sephara, who had foolishly left the whole place uncovered while a sandstorm was approaching. So long as Beklamot had been buried beneath the sands, the ruins had slumbered peacefully for thousands of years, preserved as they had been on the day when its last inhabitants finally yielded to the harshness of the changing climate and abandoned the place. Each archaeologist who had worked there since Galdo's day had taken care to expose just a small section of the site and to put up screens and sand fences to guard against the unlikely but serious danger of a sandstorm. Until now. She had put up the usual screens and fences too, of course. But not in front of the new digs, not in the sanctuary area where she had focused her investigations. Some of Beklamot's oldest and finest buildings were there. And she, impatient to begin excavating, carried away by her perpetual buoyant urge to go on and on, had failed to take the most elementary precautions. It hadn't seemed that way to her at the time, naturally. But now, with the demonic roaring of the sandstorm in her ears, and the sky black with destruction, just as well, Sephara thought, that I won't survive this. And therefore won't have to read what they're going to say about me in every book on archaeology that gets published in the next 50 years. The great site of Beklamot, which yielded unparalleled data about the early development of civilization on Kalgash, until its unfortunate destruction as the result of the slipshod excavation practices employed by the young, ambitious Sephara 89 of Saro University.
I think it's ending, Balik whispered.
What is, she said.
The storm. Listen, it's getting quiet out there.
We must be buried in so much sand that we can't hear anything, that's all.
No, we aren't buried, Sephara.
Balik tugged at the tarpaulin in front of them and managed to lift it a little way. Sephara peered out into the open area between the cliff and the wall of the city. She couldn't believe her eyes. What she saw was the clear, deep blue of the sky and the gleam of sunlight. It was only the bleak, chilly white glow of the double suns, Tano and Setha, but just now it was the most beautiful light she ever wanted to see. The storm had passed through. Everything was calm again. And where was the sand? Why wasn't everything entombed in sand? The city was still visible. The great blocks of the stone wall, the shimmering glitter of the mosaics, the peaked stone roof of the Temple of the Suns. Even most of their tents were still standing, including nearly all of the important ones. Only the camp where the workers lived had been badly damaged, and that could be repaired in a few hours. Astounded, still not daring to believe it, Sephara stepped out of the shelter and looked around. The ground was clear of loose sand. The hard-baked, tight-packed, dark stratum that had formed the surface of the land in the excavation zone could still be seen. It looked different now, abraded in a curious, scrubbed way, but it was clear of any deposit the storm might have brought. Balik said wonderingly,
"First came the sand, and then came the wind behind it. And the wind picked up all the sand that got dropped on us, picked it up as fast as it fell, and scooped it right on along to the south. A miracle, Sephara. That's the only thing we can call it. Look, you can see where the ground's been scraped, where the whole shallow upper layer of ground sand's been cleaned away by the wind. Maybe 50 years' worth of erosion in 5 minutes, but..."
Sephara was scarcely listening. She caught Balik by the arm and turned him to the side, away from the main sector of their excavation site. "Look there," she said.
"Where? What?"
she pointed.
"The hill of Thombo."
The broad-shouldered stratigrapher stared.
"Gods, it's been slit right up the middle."
The hill of Thombo was an irregular, middling high mound some 15 minutes' walk south of the main part of the city. No one had worked it in well over 100 years, not since the second expedition of the great pioneer Galdo 221, and Galdo hadn't found anything of significance in it. It was generally considered to be nothing but a midden heap on which the citizens of Old Becklemont had tossed their kitchen garbage. Interesting enough of itself, yes, but trivial in comparison with the wonders that abounded everywhere else in the site. Apparently, though, the Hill of Thombo had taken the fullest brunt of the storm, and what generations of archaeologists had not bothered to do, the violence of the sandstorm had achieved in only a moment. An erratic, zigzagging strip had been ripped from the face of the hill, like some terrible wound, laying bare much of the interior of its upper slope. And experienced field workers like Safera and Balik needed only a single glance to understand the importance of what was now exposed.
"A town site under the midden," Balik murmured.
"More than one, I think. Possibly a series," Safera said.
"You think?"
"Look, look there on the left," Balik whistled.
"Isn't that a wall in crosshatch style under the corner of that cyclopean foundation?"
"You've got it." A shiver ran down Safera's spine. She turned to Balik and saw that he was as astounded as she was. His eyes were wide. His face was pale.
"In the name of darkness," he muttered huskily, "what do we have here, Safera?"
"I'm not sure, but I'm going to start finding out right this minute." She looked back at the shelter under the cliff where Thuvik and his men still crouched in terror, making holy signs and babbling prayers in low, stunned voices, as if unable to comprehend that they were safe from the power of the storm. "Thuvik," Safera yelled, gesturing vigorously, almost angrily at him. "Come on out of there, you and your men. We've got work to do."
3. Harim 682 was a big, beefy man of about 50, with great slabs of muscle bulging on his arms and chest, and a good thick insulating layer of fat over that. Shirin, studying him through the window of the hospital room, knew right away that he and Harim were going to get along.
"I've always been partial to people who are, well, oversized," the psychologist explained to Kalaratan and Kubello. "Having been one myself for most of my life, you understand. Not that I've ever been a muscle man like this one."
Shirin laughed pleasantly.
"I'm blubber through and through, except for here, of course," he added, tapping the side of his head. "What kind of work does this harem do?"
"Longshoreman," Kalaratan said. 35 years on the Jonglor docks. He won a ticket to the opening day of the Tunnel of Mystery in a lottery. Took his whole family. They were all affected to some degree, but he was the worst. That's very embarrassing to him, that a great, strong man like him should have such a total breakdown."
"I can imagine," Shirin said. "I'll take that into account. Let's talk with him, shall we?" They entered the room. Harim was sitting up, staring without interest at a spinner cube that was casting light in half a dozen colors on the wall opposite his bed. He smiled affably enough when he saw Kalaratan, but seemed to stiffen when he noticed the lawyer Kubello walking behind the hospital director, and his face turned completely glacial at the sight of Shirin.
"Who's he?"
he asked Kalaratan.
"Another lawyer?"
"Not at all. This is Shirin 501 from Sorrow University. He's here to help you get well."
"Huh," Harim snorted. "Another double brain. What good have any of you done for me?"
"Absolutely right," Shirin said. "The only one who can really help Harim get well is Harim, eh? You know that, and I know that. And maybe I can persuade the hospital people here to see that, too."
He sat down on the edge of the bed. It creaked beneath the psychologist's bulk.
"At least they have decent beds in this place, though. They must be pretty good if they can hold the two of us at the same time. Don't like lawyers, I gather. You and me both, friend."
"Miserable troublemakers is all they are," Harim said. "Full of tricks they are. They make you say things you don't mean, telling you that they can help you if you say such and such, and then they end up using your own words against you. That's the way it seems to me, anyway."
Shirin looked up at Kalaratan.
"Is it absolutely necessary that Kubello be here for this interview? I think it might go a little more smoothly without him."
"I am authorized to take part in any..."
Kubello began stiffly.
"Please," Kalaratan said, and the word had more force than politeness behind it. "Shirin's right. 3 visitors at once may be too many for Harim. Today, anyway. And you've already heard his story."
"Well,"
Kubello said, his face dark. But after a moment, he turned and went out of the room. Shirin surreptitiously signaled to Kalaratan that he should take a seat in the far corner.
Then, turning to the man in the bed, he smiled his most agreeable smile and said, "It's been pretty rough, hasn't it?"
"You said it."
"How long have you been in here?"
Harim shrugged.
"I guess a week, or 2 weeks, or maybe a little more. I don't know, I guess, ever since..."
He fell silent. "The Jongleur Exposition?" Sheeran prompted.
"Since I took that ride, yes."
"It's been a little more than just a week or two," Sheeran said.
"Has it?"
Harim's eyes took on a glazed look. He didn't want to hear about how long he'd been in the hospital. Changing tack, Sheeran said, "I bet you never dreamed a day would come when you'd tell yourself you'd be glad to get back to the docks, eh?" With a grin, Harim said,
"You can say that again. Boy, what I wouldn't give to be slinging those crates around tomorrow."
He looked at his hands. Big, powerful hands, the fingers thick, flattened at the tips. One of them crooked from some injury long ago.
"I'm getting soft laying here all this time. By the time I get back to work, I won't be any good anymore."
"What's keeping you here, then? Why don't you just get up and put your street clothes on and get out of here?"
Kalaratan from the corner made a warning sound. Sheeran gestured at him to keep quiet. Harim gave Sheeran a startled look.
"Just get up and walk out?"
"Why not? You aren't a prisoner."
"But if I did that... if I did that..."
The dock worker's voice trailed off.
"If you did that, what?" Sheeran asked.
For a long time, Harim was silent, face downcast, brow heavily knitted. Several times he began to speak, but cut himself off. The psychologist waited patiently. Finally, Harim said in a tight, husky, half-strangled tone,
I can't go out there because of the... because of the..."
He struggled with himself.
"The darkness," he said.
"The darkness," said Sheeran. The word hung there between them like a tangible thing. Harim looked troubled by it, even abashed. Sheeran remembered that among people of Harim's class, it was a word that was rarely used in polite company. To Harim, it was, if not actually obscene, then in some sense sacrilegious. No one on Kalgash liked to think about darkness. But the less education one had, the more threatening it was to let one's mind dwell on the possibility that the six friendly suns might somehow totally disappear from the sky all at once, that utter blackness might reign. The idea was unthinkable, literally unthinkable.
"The darkness, yes,"
Harim said.
"What I'm afraid of is that if I go outside, I'll find myself in the darkness again. That's what it is. The dark. All over again."
"Complete symptom reversal in the last few weeks,"
Kalaratan said in a low voice.
"At first it was just the opposite. You couldn't get him to go indoors unless you sedated him. A powerful case of claustrophobia first, that is. And then, after some time, a total switch to claustrophilia. We think it's a sign that he's healing."
"Maybe so," Sheeran said, "but if you don't mind..." To Harim he said gently,
"You were one of the first to ride through the Tunnel of Mystery, weren't you?"
"On the very first day."
A note of pride came into Harim's voice.
"There was a city lottery. 100 people won free rides. There must have been 1 million tickets sold, and mine was the 5th one picked. Me, my wife, my son, my 2 daughters. We all went on it the very first day."
"Do you want to tell me a little about what it was like?"
"Well,"
Harim said,
"it was..."
He paused.
"I never was in darkness. Ever, you know. Not even a dark room. Not ever. It wasn't something that interested me. We always had a god light in the bedroom when I was growing up, and when I got married and had my own house, I just naturally had one there, too. My wife feels the same way. Darkness isn't natural. It isn't anything that was meant to be."
"Yet you entered the lottery."
"Well, this was just once, and it was like entertainment, you know. Something special. A holiday treat. The big exposition. The 500th year of the city, right? Everybody was buying tickets. And I figured, well, this must be something different. This must be something really good. Or else, Why would they have built it? So I bought the ticket. And when I won, everybody at the docks was jealous. They all wished they had the ticket. Some of them even wanted to buy it from me. No, sir, I told them. Not for sale. Me and my family. This is our ticket.
So you were excited about taking the ride in the tunnel?
Yeah, you bet.
And when you were actually doing it, when the ride started, what did that feel like?
Well,
Harim began. He moistened his lips and his eyes seemed to look off into a great distance.
There were these little cars, you see. Nothing but slats inside for seats, and the cars were open on top. You got in. Six people in each one, except they let just the five of us go together because we were all one family. And it was almost enough to fill a whole car without putting a stranger in with us. And then you heard music, and the car started to move into the tunnel. Very slow it went, not like a car on the highway would, just creeping along. And then you were inside the tunnel. And then...
Chiron waited again. Go on, he said after a minute when Harim showed no sign of resuming. Tell me about it. I really want to know what it was like.
Then, the darkness,
Harim said hoarsely. His big hands were trembling at the recollection.
It came down on you like they dropped a giant hat over you, you know? And everything turned black all at once.
The trembling was becoming a violent tremor.
I heard my son, Trinit, laugh. He's a wise guy, Trinit is. He thought the darkness was something dirty, I bet you. So he was laughing, and I told him to shut up, and then one of my daughters began to cry a little, and I told her it was okay. There was nothing to worry about, and that it was just going to be for 15 minutes, and she ought to look at it like it was a treat, not something to be scared of. Then...
Silence again. This time, Chiron didn't prompt.
And then I felt it closing in on me. Everything was darkness. Darkness. You can't imagine what it was like. You can't imagine how black it was. How black. The darkness. The darkness.
Suddenly Harim shuddered, and great racking sobs came from him almost like convulsions.
The darkness. Oh, God, the darkness.
Easy, man. There's nothing to be afraid of here. Look at the sunlight. Four suns today, Harim. Easy, man.
Let me take care of this,
Kalaratan said. He had come rushing to the bedside when the sobbing began. A needle glinted in his hand. He touched it to Harim's burly arm, and there was a brief whir of sound. Harim grew calm almost at once. He slumped back against his pillow, smiling glassily.
We need to leave him now, said Kalaratan. But I've hardly only begun to... He won't make any sense again for hours now. We might as well go for lunch.
Lunch? Yes, Chiron said half-heartedly. To his own surprise, he felt almost no appetite at all. He could scarcely remember a time when he had felt that way.
And he's one of your strongest ones? One of the most stable, yes.
What are the others like, then?
Some are completely catatonic. Others need sedation at least half the time. In the first stage, as I said, they don't want to come in out of the open. When they emerged from the tunnel, they seemed to be in perfect order, you understand, except that they had developed instant claustrophobia. They would refuse to go into buildings. Any buildings, including palaces, mansions, apartment houses, tenements, huts, shacks, lean-tos, and tents.
Chiron felt a profound sense of shock. He had done his doctoral work in darkness-induced disorders. That was why they had asked him to come here. But he had never heard of anything as extreme as this.
They wouldn't go indoors at all? Where'd they sleep? In the open.
Did anyone try to force them inside?
Oh, they did, of course they did. Whereupon these people went into violent hysterics. Some of them even became suicidal. They'd run up to a wall and hit their heads against it. Things like that. Once you did get them inside, you couldn't keep them there without a straitjacket and a good stiff injection of some strong sedative.
Sheeran looked at the big longshoreman, who was sleeping now, and shook his head. The poor devils.
That was the first phase. Harim's in the second phase now, the claustrophilic one. He's adapted to being here, and the whole syndrome has swung completely around. He knows that it's safe in the hospital, bright lights all the time, but even though he can see the suns shining through the window, he's afraid to go outside. He thinks it's dark out there.
But that's absurd, Sheeran said. It's never dark out there. The instant he said it, he felt like a fool. Claritin rubbed it in all the same, though.
We all realize that, Dr. Sheeran. Any sane person does. But the trouble with the people who have undergone trauma in the Tunnel of Mystery is that they are no longer sane.
Yes, so I gather, said Sheeran shamefacedly.
You can meet some of our other patients later today,
Claritin said.
Perhaps they'll provide you with some other perspectives on the problem. And then tomorrow, we'll take you over to see the tunnel itself. We have it closed down, of course, now that we know the difficulties. But the city fathers are very eager to find some way to reopen it. The investment, I understand, was immense. But we should have lunch first. Yes, Doctor?
Lunch, yes, said Sheeran once again, even less enthusiastically than before. 4. The great dome of the Sorrow University Observatory, rising majestically to dominate the forested slopes of Observatory Mount, glinted brilliantly in the light of late afternoon. The small red orb of Dovim had already slipped beyond the horizon, but Onos was still high in the west, and Trey and Patru, crossing the eastern sky on a sharp diagonal, etched shining trails of brightness along the dome's immense face. Binet 25, a slender, agile young man with a quick, alert way of carrying himself, darted briskly about the small apartment below the observatory in Sorrow City that he shared with his contract mate, Raista 717, gathering his books and papers together. Raista, sprawled comfortably on the worn green upholstery of their little couch, looked up and frowned. Going somewhere, Binet?
To the observatory.
It's so early, though. You usually don't go there until after Onos sets. And that won't be for hours yet.
I've got an appointment today, Raista.
She gave him a warm, seductive look. They were both graduate students in their late 20s, each an assistant professor, he in astronomy, she in biology. And they had been contract mates only 7 months. Their relationship was still in its first bloom of excitement. But problems had already arisen. He did his work in the late hours, when usually only a few of the lesser suns were in the sky. She was at her freshest and best in the period of high daylight, under the golden glow of bright Onos. Lately, he had spent more and more time at the observatory, and it was getting so they were almost never awake at the same time. Binet knew how trying that was for her. It was trying for him. All the same, the work he was doing on Kalgash's orbit was demanding stuff, and it was leading him into ever more difficult regions that he found both challenging and frightening. If only Raista would be patient just another few weeks, a month or two, maybe. Can't you stay here a little while longer this evening? She asked. His heart sank. Raista was giving him her come here and let's play look. Not easy to resist, nor did he really want to. But Imat and Faro would be waiting.
I told you I have an
appointment, yes. Well, so do I. With you.
Me?
You said yesterday you might have some free time this afternoon. I was counting on that, you know. I cleared a whole swatch of free time of my own. Did my lab work in the morning, as a matter of fact, just so...
Worse and worse, Binet thought. He did remember saying something about this afternoon, completely overlooking the fact that he had arranged to meet the two younger students. She was pouting now and somehow smiling at the same time, a trick that she managed to perfection. Binet wanted to forget all about Faro and Imat and go to her right away. But if he did that, he might be an hour late for his appointment with them, which wasn't fair. 2 hours, maybe. And he had to admit to himself that he was desperately eager to know whether their calculations had confirmed his own.